success and failure live next door to each other. And when you get to that point where you think it's over, if you can wake up and take a breath in the morning, it is not over.
Welcome to the Idea Generation Podcast, a show about creative entrepreneurs. My name is Noah Callahan Bever, and each week I get to talk to some of the most innovative ideators in culture and try to figure out how they make their creative decisions. This week, I'm honored to sit with a very special guest who is both a titan of industry with a hand in just about every facet of entertainment and also a personal inspiration of mine, Scooter Braun. I'm particularly psyched about this one because I've enjoyed a somewhat unique vantage on Scooter's career. We first met back in like 2007 when he brought Asher Roth to the Complex office, where I was EIC at the time, and I'll never forget how passionate and emphatic he was talking about his client. After that, Scooter's career would skyrocket off the success of Justin Bieber, and we would collaborate a couple times on some pretty memorable Complex cover shoots featuring the Biebs. Still, I didn't ever feel like I really knew Scooter or that I understood what animated him. Then, I had two wildly different sets of experiences that gave me some real insight. First, right before I left Complex, I hosted a show called The Blueprint, and Scooter was gracious enough to be a guest and talk shop candidly about how he built his empire and what he wanted next. What was supposed to be a 30-minute sit-down turned into a 2-hour summit. And let's just say, it reframed my ambitions. And in a somewhat tangentially related twist of fate, shortly thereafter, I left Complex to run content at Def Jam. And I actually got the opportunity to work with Scooter on a few album rollouts. And I got to see the urgency with which he moved behind the scenes and how he got things done. I can say that Scooter is one of the most impressive executives I've encountered in this industry. And my respect for him has only grown with time and exposure. In fact, full transparency, when I was contemplating launching Idea Generation back at the top of 2020, he was one of the first people that I emailed about it. A dude was kind enough to hit me back within a couple minutes and invite me to breakfast later that week to talk out my plan. I cannot even explain the battery that conversation put in my back, the value of the marketplace insight that he shared, or how his thinking about the business's potential opened my aperture. So I'm excited to sit down with him again, as his life and our personal rapport have changed pretty dramatically since our last public conversation back in 2017. Scooter has enjoyed unbelievable successes, like selling his company for over $1 billion, but also been dealt gutting challenges, like a public divorce and the adjustment to co-parenting. Still, he's managed to stay engaged professionally, and perhaps even more importantly, and more impressively, he's pushed himself to grow personally. In any case, without further ado, let's get into how he did it.
How did your parents' professional life inform your ambitions?
My parents never really talked to me about money or business. My mom was one of the first females in the country to have her own private practice as an orthodontist. I think having an independent working mom informed how I saw partnership between spouses, how I kind of saw the world and how I saw equality. But what I do is so different than what they do. I mean, they really had the 9-to-5 and then had emergencies here and there for patients, but the path I chose wasn't school, wasn't a 9-to-5. It's almost as if I wanted to make my own path. So while their work ethic informed how I saw the world and their ability to achieve, I also think I so desperately wanted to go on my own path.
In high school, you played AAU basketball. What do you think is the most lasting, significant things that you learned from youth athletics?
Well, one, the most lasting thing is the friendships. I have a text chain on my phone between me and there's seven guys from my old AAU team. And we still, to this day, talk all year long on this text chain, checking up on each other, cracking jokes. And we come together for a weekend every year around March Madness. We have a good time and we're kids again. And those relationships, both on and off the court, of living in those really, you know, rundown hotels every single weekend. But what it informed is teamwork. It informed lasting friendships. It informed my ability to not judge anything in the first quarter. Two things I remember from AAU are, one, we were never allowed to celebrate until the game was won. We always had to respect losing the way we respected winning. If a game was close, our coach would tell us to play the game as if you were down 15. So he wanted a 15-point lead, and then you're tied. So you never take anything for granted. I mean, I think that informed a lot of the way I saw business. I could think long term, but I always could address the moment. And I could tell you, I miss those days. I was in Las Vegas years back, and suddenly I just saw all these teenagers that were like 6'6", 6'7", walking around. And I was the little guy on my team, obviously. And I just stopped them and I said, excuse me, are you here for the Adidas Big Time tournament? And they were like, yeah. And I like grabbed these kids and I was like, these are some of the best days of your life. Don't let them go. Anybody who's played kind of those at youth athletics or traveled with youth athletics knows there's a camaraderie. It's just that's a special time in your life. I look back on it fondly and I'm really grateful. And it also really gave me my love for hip hop.
Do you consider yourself a competitive person?
I think that I compete with myself. I like to push myself. I think that there was a point in my life where insecurities played into the role of you're young and you want to compare and you want to see what somebody's doing, you get competitive. But I think I got into a place in my life where I genuinely want to see people succeed. I call it my vacation theory. You know, if everyone's doing well, it means they can pay for their own vacation. And then you don't have to, you know, be the one paying for the vacation. So I want everyone to do well. And my competition is who I see in the mirror.
So you, like me, are a college dropout.
Yeah.
Obviously, you got a lot out of that experience just being in Atlanta and being on the party scene. When you think about your kids, do you feel like college is an important or a necessary thing for them?
Look, I don't know what college is going to be like when my kids are that age. What I can tell you is my sister, who is a doctor, a dermatologist, is like, when my kid wants to drop out of college, I'm going to yell at you. What I would say is everyone's path is different. Everyone's journey is different. I don't see college as something I'm going to tell my kids they need unless they want to be a lawyer or a doctor. They need certain diplomas. The reason why I want my kids to go to college is because I regret missing out on so much of my youth. And my path is my path, and I'm grateful. But when I talk to people who had those 4 years and these great memories and the camaraderie they have of those memories together before they enter the real working world, there's just something so unique about the community of college if you actually do it that way. It's an opportunity to grow up socially within that community before you enter the real world. And I had a different type of college because mine was Atlanta. Once I left school, it was really just the city of Atlanta, the relationships that I made and throwing the parties and doing the different things that I did. But I would encourage my kids to enjoy that. But if their journey takes them on a different path, I also have to respect that. You make plans and then life shows up. I'll encourage my kids to enjoy that experience and get the most out of it, but it's also going to be their human experience.
While you're in Atlanta, you start your sort of professional career first selling fake IDs and then promoting some parties. It takes a very particular skill set and hustle to be a successful party promoter. What do you think it is about you that made you so good at that?
I was good at putting myself in other people's shoes. I was good at seeing what was missing, what can make it unique. I like joy, and I like to think of what kind of things could I do to bring people joy. And I find myself in some ways to be extraordinary, but in many ways to be very ordinary. So the music that I like is liked by a lot of people, or the type of party and element that I want to create is liked by a lot of people. So by being that ordinary, I kind of had a sense of taste of what would work for a lot of people. And I think a lot of people just don't make the effort to try, or they don't make the effort to go do that. And the idea is that most people call genius are the things that are so obvious. Just no one did them yet, or they haven't done them again.
I think it's everyone's nightmare to like throw a party and no one show up. What was it that gave you the confidence that I'm going to put together an event and all these people are going to come?
I think that was ignorance. My father used to come in our room every single night and he would say, you know, bronze are different, you boys are special. And I think after years and years of hearing that, I just thought, why not me? So I remember I stopped by this club and there's this guy, B.A., his partner is this guy, Kerry, and they had a club called Chaos in Atlanta in Buckhead. And I just was like, hey, if I bring people here next week, would you give me money? Because I'd stopped selling fake IDs and I didn't want to be broke. And he was like, yeah, how many people can you bring? And I said, how many people does it hold? He's like, 800. And I was like, yeah, sure. And he looked at me like I was insane. And I didn't know that that was hard. I just thought, why not me? And I printed a bunch of flyers at Kinko's and got a bunch of girls that I was friends with to pass out the flyers with me, got a DJ who I knew could play really good hip hop and rock and roll, and 800 people showed up. So I think that's partially grinding, the right time, the right moment, the right opportunity. And then when I saw that, it kind of clicked. I didn't know any better. I was like, why can't it be me? And then I think once you go from the idea of potential to expectation, mm-hmm. that's when you see what people are made out of. I had the potential to throw these parties, and the potential started to show. And then there was an expectation, can he do it again? Can you get people to come again and again? And that's when the fear of failure comes. That's when I was like, well, now I'm doing this, and now I'm seeing it successful in this. Like, I don't want to fail. Like, I want to make this bigger. And at that point in my life, fear of failure really drove me.
Driven by a fear of failure, Scooter used his natural charisma and naive ambition to make a name for himself throwing parties in the Atlanta nightlife scene. As his reputation grew, he started attracting the attention of local star executives, like So-So Def founder Jermaine Dupri, former EVP of Def Jam Shakir Stewart, and Ludacris manager Shaka Zulu. These heavyweights appreciated Scooter's hustle, and each in their own way put an arm around him. By his 20th birthday, he dropped out of college and started working as a marketer for Dupri, and that experience would open his eyes and broaden his ambitions.
After you promote these parties and you start meeting people, you end up linking with Jermaine Dupri and working for him for several years. What were the most important things that you learned during that period of apprenticeship?
Whether it be Jermaine or Shakir Stewart or Shaka Zulu, these guys that kind of took me in Atlanta. I worked for Jermaine for 4 years. Jermaine just told me I had more potential. You know, I think in the very beginning, he said, you have more potential than parties. So it's just the belief in me that made a massive difference. I think when someone believes in you and sees that you're more than what you're showing, that can change your life. And Jermaine believed in me. Shakir believed in me. Shaka believed in me. And then Jermaine exposed me to other things. I had never been to Los Angeles until Jermaine took me. I had never seen that world until Jermaine pulled me into it. And it's like rich dad, poor dad, that philosophy. It's like sometimes you just got to be exposed to it.
You've talked a lot about how you no longer manifest, but in that period, you were willing yourself into these rooms. What did that manifesting actually look like on the ground in that moment?
Let me say this. I didn't say I no longer manifest. I just look at it differently. Okay. I still manifest, but I don't believe that it's just manifestation. I believe that I manifest things and I'm participating in the universe. Michael Singer talks about it in the book Surrender Experiment. It's this concept of like the universe has been around for billions of years and we come in for our lifespan of like 60 to 100 years and act like we're manifesting everything, but it's gone perfectly fine before us. We do play a role. We can manifest certain things, but when it doesn't go our way, it might be because the universe is saying, that's not the lesson I want you to learn. I need you to learn something else. It's like you can make a play in basketball and you're definitely the person who made the decision to make that pass. But there's so many other elements going on the court that play a role in what happens in that game. So you're participating in the game. You're not controlling the game completely. So the only action that's wrong is inaction. The reason I say that is like, you actually don't know what you're participating in unless you participate. So I think in those early years, I was throwing myself in the ring. I was allowing myself to see what opportunities could happen for me if I was willing to get in there and try. And I think for people watching this, that's the thing I would encourage them the most. You're sitting there right now and you know you have some ambition and you have some dream and you've been procrastinating. You're like, I'm gonna get to it tomorrow and I got my job and I can't do this or I can't do that. And one day you're gonna wake up and say, where did all the time go? You don't know what you're capable of until you give yourself an opportunity to find out. And I think that at a very young age, because of, I don't know, just the way I'm programmed, I was like, why not? Why not me? Why not participate? So like I wasn't waiting for someone to tell me go. I would see something and I was like, let's go for it. And I think the exposure that Jermaine gave me to the upper echelons of success within the music industry made me believe I deserved to be there and I could be there. And that's why that's my brother for life. I'm grateful to him beyond because he saw a kid throwing parties in Atlanta, Georgia and was like, come with me, I'm gonna show you the rest of this.
When you leave working with Jermaine and decided to go out on your own, how did you put the pieces together to even endeavor to do this? And what kind of runway had you built for yourself in order to get SP Projects off the ground?
When I left Jermaine, It was a combination of me knowing it was time to go and some things happened that, like, I had to go. And I did, like, a campaign deal for Ludacris with Cadillac for 2 miles an hour with the Pontiac Solstice and made a little money from that and a little calling card to say, okay, I can do marketing for outside of Germain. And it got me little marketing gigs here and there. My brother was backpacking South America, and I always thought backpacking was something kids did to, like, escape the real world. But I was kind of lost, so I just bought a one-way ticket to Chile. I met him there, and we hit South America, 15-hour bus rides, $5 to $20 a night hostels, like living out of a backpack for a month. And in that moment, I rediscovered my belief in humanity. I rediscovered that it's not kids avoiding life. They're living an adventure every single day. Every day you wake up, you're out there in the world finding something new, exploring. I came back completely rejuvenated, and I said, okay, I'm going to do this. And I had enough money for 13 months before I went broke. And I said, I'm going to find acts that I believe in that no one else wants, and I'm going to make that my calling card. I'm going to find 2 to 3 acts, because Shaka Zulu, Ludacris' manager, was like, if you find one, you're good. Find two, it's crazy. So I was like, I'm going to find two. And I wrote down a plan. I said, I'm finding a kid who can rap his ass off but speaks to all these college kids who doesn't have anybody directly talking to them, and discovered Asher Roth on MySpace. And I had this idea of, like, I was a big Michael Jackson fan of the Jackson 5, of this angelic voice singing love songs that made you believe in love again. And Justin fit that mold. I had these ideas, and then, like, it kind of started to show itself, and I risked everything. And everyone thought I was in Atlanta, was killing it, because I had my apartment, and I had this kid living in a little townhouse illegally, and this guy living in, like, this broken down house 2 minutes away from that, and Asher was babysitting Justin sometimes, and, like, it was wild back those days. But I fully believed in these guys, and I risked everything. I was in month 11. I was 25 years old, and my dad called me just to check up, see how I'm doing, and I didn't know why. I just broke down crying. And I was like, Dad, I got 2 more months before I'm broke, and no one knows, and these people are depending on me. I got this kid, 13-year-old kid and his mom, and I got, you know, Asher and his buddy. Like, this is done. And he was like, look, you haven't listened to me since you were 18 years old. You've come this far. You said you got 2 more months to see it through. And the next day, Asher walked into my apartment and played me I Love College. And that song saved our company. And it's interesting, all these years later, to me, that was like this pivotal moment that, like, defined a lot of success that was to come. And Asher and I have stayed close, and we talk about it now, and he almost wishes if things were a little bit different. And you have to realize, like, just because you see something as this big defining accolade, it might not be the same for someone else in their journey. And you just have to respect everyone else's journeys. And he and I have talked about that as friends. But for me, in my journey, that was this idea that success and failure live next door to each other. And when you get to that point where you think it's over, if you can wake up and take a breath in the morning, it is not over.
When you reflect back on yourself and your own performance in that period, what do you think were the holes in your game as a manager?
I think what made me a really great manager in the beginning of my career was my deep insecurity and my need for others to tell me that I had achieved something, or I had helped them, or I was worthy because they told me I was worthy. And I think that a lot of managers suffer from depression. I have a wonderful relationship with the artists I work with. It goes in ups and downs, and you live through those ups and downs together, and people become family because of that. I've been fired and rehired twice now. But what made me a great manager in the beginning of my career was how much I didn't love myself almost. It was like I needed to help them so they could tell me I had value. And I think that the last couple years of me rediscovering myself almost allows me to be a worse manager, because I don't have that insatiable need to find that satisfaction outside of myself. But it's made me a much better leader, because I'm comfortable enough to scale and trust other people and help them build something. And I think we've built a much bigger business and something more robust and something that could help our clients beyond, because we have so many services and great people here. But I think I've evolved and changed. That's why I'm not a day-to-day manager anymore, because how I've changed doesn't make me the most suited person to do that job.
With management, it has always struck me that there's a very delicate balancing act that you have to do, because on the one hand, I mean, you are there at the request of the talent, and so you are fighting for what is in their best interest, of course, but sometimes what they want and what is in their best interest, or at least what you perceive to be their best interest, are at odds. How do you negotiate that?
I think in the beginning of my career, I thought I was right. And as long as we had success, I believed that I was justified in what I was doing. And like I said, my father believed in me more than anyone in the world, but he also gave me that pattern, because I don't want to take anything away. This is one of the greatest fathers in the world, but he was doing the best he could with what he had, like all of us do. And as an adult, I realized there's things about the way I was raised that I don't want to do with my children. And he and I had a conversation with certain things that I was like, that wasn't okay. And he looked at me and he said, but it worked. And my response to him at this place in my life was, no, I was great despite it, not because of it, and so were you. And unfortunately, I think sometimes the acts that I worked with, they had ambitions and they had certain things they wanted to do. And I thought, okay, well, I disagree with them and I'm just gonna force the issue as long as we're still successful. But if you continue to do that over and over again, that artist doesn't necessarily feel ownership of that success. They deserve to have the same bumps and bruises that we all go through life. They deserve to have a trusting of their gut and be wrong and then be right on the other side so they can have ownership of their craft. And I'm much better about that now than I was then. I think that I just was like, as long as I'm right, as long as we're successful, let's just keep going, let's keep going. And I think if I was to look at myself as a younger manager, I would say who was right and who was wrong. What I definitely know now and what I've been doing for probably the last 5 to 7 years has really been saying, this is your journey. I'm here to help facilitate it. I will tell you if I disagree, but it has to be your decision. Because in the beginning of my career, I just had tunnel vision. And that only works for so long.
You've had several clients over the course of your career who have had personal troubles. Justin, when he was late teen, Demi, Kanye. And anytime you see a talent going through this, typical Twitter reaction is, oh, their team needs to help them. Shouldn't this person be helping? But obviously, that is much easier said than done through a computer screen. When you're actually in that situation and you are the manager, how do you think the best way to approach that kind of situation
is? So I've been asked this question a lot. And this is my honest, honest answer. Because someone once said to me, they were like, you're a manager, you're not God. Like, why do people think? But I also see the other side of it. I remember watching the Amy Winehouse documentary and the manager said it wasn't my responsibility to help her. It was my responsibility to get her on stage. And I found that to be absolutely outrageous. I think it's almost as if you're dealing with someone who's dealing with addiction and you go to Al-Anon meetings. The only person who's going to turn that addiction around is the person themselves. They have to make a conscious decision. Doesn't mean you don't have a responsibility to try and help or be there for that person or be a place they can come back to that's safe. So I think if you're choosing to be on someone's team that's going through something, you have to make yourself available to do the right thing. You have to make yourself a resource to be there for that person. If you're not willing to do that, you should not be on their team. That's my personal opinion. However, it's not on you either. That's a human being, an adult, who's having an experience. They're making decisions for themselves. And Justin, even through his teenage years, like it started happening after he was 18, he was a young adult, so I wanted to be there for him because he was going through something. But like, that's also his experience. So you want to be there for them as much as you possibly can. And you want to be a resource so you can look back and say, I did the right thing. But if you're doing it and you're defining your success in being there for them based on the reaction of the outside world, then that's a transactional thing. That's not real unconditional being there for somebody. That's being there for someone because you're looking for some kind of praise. And you're gonna find yourself on the other side, on the wrong side of it every single time if you're acting that way. So my response to you is know that you should be there for them if you're choosing to be on the team, and know that you might come out the winner, the villain, or not even part of the story. And that shouldn't be part of your thought process. You should be there for someone because it's the right thing to do.
That makes a lot of sense.
It's the toughest one. Be there for someone and know that you might be the villain. When people say you fly too close to the sun, sometimes you're there for someone and you end up getting hurt because you try to help them. Like if people say like no good deed goes unpunished, that's why it's so important that you can't be defined by someone else. You got to know your own truth. If you went in there with the right intention and you try to help somebody, you can't let yourself be defined by whatever story's told, because the only story that matters is your truth.
In managing artists, you have to be able to be incredibly candid with them and have tough conversations and also private conversations. But we live in a world where anytime anything goes sideways, everything is aired out in public. How do you navigate that, being behind the scenes and wanting to be honest?
You have to know your truth. You have to know the people that love you. They know who you are. You have to live in a place of truth. Like, people are going to tell their story. People might have revisionist history. They just might make up a story. Sometimes you got to take ownership of your own mistakes, because you're the one who wishes it didn't go down that way because you've learned, but you did. So I would say you can't live your life defined by how someone else is going to tell your story. Because the truth is, no one's going to remember any of us in a couple hundred years. There's going to be another one of us. The biggest superstars in the world, there were people just as big before that you and I would name and would be like, huh? But they were the biggest things in Hollywood. And so there's always going to be those defining characters within their generations, but our impact is the only thing that remains, not necessarily who our names were. So I think, one, don't have an ego about it. Two, don't let someone else define you. And then three, have empathy. Have empathy that if somebody's doing that, that might have nothing to do with you. And they're going through their human experience, and you can choose to react in rage, or you can choose to say, what am I going to learn from this moment? How do I be better the next time? And then also boundaries. I thought my whole life, people would say, oh, boundaries are there to protect you. And I thought I had to be tough the way I was raised. So I was like, I don't need boundaries. I don't need protecting. And then someone I really respect taught me recently that boundaries are there to help you educate someone else on how you deserve to be treated. And if someone is going to air out laundry constantly with no context, you're allowed to not have them in your life. You're allowed to walk away. You're allowed to have boundaries from them. You don't have to respond to them. And it's your choice whether you bring someone into your life, whether you bring them into your castle or not. And you deserve to protect your castle.
In the 5 years since our first conversation, you've enjoyed some incredible highs, selling the business for the better part of $2 billion. But then you've also had both personal challenges and then some professional things, like buying Big Machine and getting caught up in a back and forth with Taylor Swift. What do you think it was about that moment in your career that led to this sort of tumultuous period?
I think every story has arcs. It has to kind of go up and down. You're on the rise. It's great. When you get to a certain point, people are going to take shots. But I just look at it as like it needed to happen. It was a gift. But you ever heard the story of Joseph in the Technicolor Dreamcoat?
Yeah.
So his brothers were jealous of him. They faked his death. He gets sold into slavery. He has this incredibly hard life. But then he's a seer. He can see things, and someone in jail tells the Pharaoh about the seer and the jailer, and he brings him out, and he saves the Pharaoh from the famine, and he becomes the number two most powerful person in Egypt behind the Pharaoh. And then his brothers come to town because there's a drought, and he sees them. He has them arrested, knowing the rest of the family will come. His father's now dead. They get brought in front of the number two most powerful person in all of Egypt, and they're like, why are we here? And he says, you don't recognize me. He says, I'm your brother. And they think, we are screwed. Like, this dude is going to send us to the dungeon. How did he get here? We said he was dead and sold him to slavery. And he looks at them and he goes, if I hadn't gone through everything that I went through, I would not have the wisdom to be the man I am today. And I'm not going to hurt you. In fact, I'm going to take care of you and your family forever, because I'm grateful that you chose to give me that lesson, whether you realize it or not. I'm going to choose to have empathy for this moment and actually see it as a plus. And it's one of the most selfless stories in the Torah Bible. And I choose to look at it as like these moments that you think someone's attacking you, or these moments that you think are unfair. One, you play a role in every one of these moments because you're part of the story. And two, You can choose to be angry, resentful, bitter, and actually become the story in your anger. Or you can choose to say, thank you for playing a role in my growth, and move on. And I think this whole process has led me to understanding that's worth working towards.
Something that I struggle with is when I look at my success at Complex, a lot of what drove it was just having an insatiable desire to win and working all day, all night, never putting it down. And now I have two kids and a wife and a family. Obviously, that all takes somewhat of a backseat to it. And I struggle with the idea of, can I still operate at the level that I am accustomed to, that I want to, that I aspire towards, and maintain all of this over here and nurture it and recognize that it is obviously, in the end of the day, more important than being very good at what I do. It seems like from the outside, the last couple of years, you've spent a lot of time and energy figuring that balance out. And what does that look like?
My first tattoo, I was 18 years old. It says family on my wrist. And it's a strange thing for an 18-year-old to tattoo family on their wrist and not be talking about their current family, mom and dad. I was talking about my future family because all I wanted to do was be a family man. And I wanted to be a family man, and I wanted to show the industry that you could be super successful and be a family man and balance it and everything else. And then I look back, and here I put this family on a pedestal. I put this whole thing, and I was doing everything for to be an example. But that's actually not being a family man. It's not about a community project. It's about being there for them, and it has nothing to do with everyone else. And it wasn't until I lost my marriage, that's when I had to face myself and say, why am I falling apart right now? Because this isn't working. And other people were like, I didn't have any exposure to divorce growing up. I couldn't get my head around it. And I realize now that it had to happen for me to become present. It had to happen for me to do this self-work, to become present again, to deal with whether it be childhood trauma or inherited trauma. I had to face my inner demons and say, what is this for? Why is this for you? And when you say I'm finding that balance, sometimes it's when you lose something, that's when you really start to say, wait a second, what is important? It's not even a balancing. I now have my priorities in order, because when I have my kids 50% of the time, I know that 50% of the time they might not be with me. So when they're with me, they get 100% of me. Before, I probably took it a little bit for granted. I probably said, oh, I love my kids. I came home every day to put them to sleep. I was proud to be a really good dad, but I thought they're gonna be here tomorrow. I can go do the work a little bit more. I can grind a little bit more. I can have this insatiable need to win, because I just thought they're there. I built this script that they and my wife, they're gonna be there. And anything you have to take like, what is my responsibility in this? And deep down, I knew I was a really good dad. I was a good husband. Like, could I be better? And I knew I could. But I kept focusing on this need to win, thinking that will be there tomorrow. I need to focus on this right now. And when that world broke, I realized there's no time but now. And I had to lose something to gain everything. So it's not even to me about finding a balance. It's about finding out what you're not willing to live without. And I'm not willing to live without my time with them. And I'm not willing to be anything less than this version ever again. And I think what I'm learning is to love my essence, that all the achievements and all that, my friends don't love me for any of that. I created Scooter to be stronger in the world because I deep down growing up didn't think I was enough. Even with all the confidence my dad instilled in me and all the things that happened to me, there was something inside me for other reasons that I didn't think I was enough. So I had to create Scooter. And when the perfect little world and the success and the family and everything else started to crumble a little bit, there was no foundation of Scott to pick it up, and I had to go back and get that foundation and realize that I was enough. And I'm still learning that every single day. One of my really good friends said to me the other day, she was like, I just wish you could see what I see. And I'm working through that to be able to see that 95% of the people in my life see me, and I need to stop seeing myself at times, the 5% that I allow in the negativity or my own insecurities, my own stuff. And that's the human experience, and that's the struggle I'll be going through the rest of my life. I think I'm starting to learn now a lot of things that I didn't know back then. I think the last couple years through COVID, a lot of things changed in my life. And when I couldn't fix certain things, I realized I had to fix myself. And I had to unlearn certain habits and certain traits, and I went on a real deep path of self-work, which I think sometimes people think is a negative thing. They're like, oh, you're in self-work because you're losing it. I wasn't losing it. I just didn't have a clear path anymore. I was confused, and I built such a story for myself as Scooter that I had lost the little kid Scott along the way. And I went on a path to rediscover that and go back to my childhood and then discover who I am today and relearn and let things go. I was able to ask Jeff Bezos, what do you want? This is one of the most commercially successful human beings of all time. And he looked at me and he said, I want to evolve. And I thought that was a cheat code. Here it is. You don't need $200 billion to start evolving as a person, to evolve in your intimacy, evolve as a father, evolve as a friend, evolve as a brother, just evolve as a human. So I've started to implement more and more of that into my life. And it's been the hardest yet most rewarding journey I've ever had in the last 3 years.
After facing challenges on both the professional and personal fronts, Scooter took some time to reflect and adjust his approach. And then he promptly got back to work, and it paid off in a big way. In 2021, he sold his company, Ithaca Holdings, to Korean multinational Hive for a staggering $1 billion. And after making the acquisition, Hive founder Bang Si-hyuk, aka the man behind BTS, made Scooter the CEO of Hive America, where he oversees a consolidated portfolio of the multimedia music company's U.S. operation and his existing enterprises.
You built this business, you've sold the business, you're now still overseeing it. What is it that makes you get out of bed every morning and want to keep doing it?
I'm still curious. I think the day I stop and go in a different direction is the day I stop being curious. And I don't know if that's tomorrow, if that's 5 years from now. I know that my curiosity about certain things has changed, and now I'm curious about other things. And as long as I continue to have a platform to be curious that I enjoy, I'll keep doing it. I love my new partner, Bang. He had a belief in me that we can go do something really unique, and we're actually planning some really fun stuff.
What has the transition been like from being the captain of your own ship to now being part of this much larger company?
It's different, but the part of the reason I did it is because Bang didn't want me to not be a captain of my ship. And even the people I'm pursuing now for our company to acquire and bring into our business, they're other entrepreneurs. And my biggest thing to them is he doesn't let me call him anything but partner. He's never interfered with my ship. We work in tandem. If you're going to join this, you're going to be a partner. You're not going to be an employee of such and so. You're not reporting. Yeah, we're reporting numbers and certain things, but like you can build with other entrepreneurs if you respect their fact that they're an entrepreneur. And Chairman Bang is a dreamer. He's brilliant. And he respects the entrepreneurial experience because he's an entrepreneur himself. And I think that's why I'm in a very unique experience with someone who not only is a leader, but is just as vulnerable as I am. We can talk about things, and if something's going wrong in the business, we're not too afraid to tell each other, because we know we'll get through it together. I'll never forget, right before we closed the deal, he and I were doing Zooms every couple days to get to know each other to see if we wanted to do the deal. And one day he said to me, the team has a lot more due diligence to do, but I'm gonna close the deal next week. I don't even know if we're gonna have the diligence done. And I was like, what's going on? He said, in the West, you guys always talk about the transaction. How do we get the deal done? How do we get the deal done? But in the East, we talk about what we're gonna do once the deal is done. How are we gonna build together? How are we gonna work together? He goes, in all our Zoom conversations, you never once talked to me about the transaction. You talked to me about music. You talked to me about culture. You talked to me about family. You talked to me about philosophy. You talked to me about fun things that we can do together. Whatever we find in diligence, it doesn't matter because you and I together will deal with it on the other side. And that's why I'm going to do this deal. And that's a very, very unique partner to have. And that made me, that conversation had me call my guy and say, close the deal. I'm ready. Let's do this. But there will be a day where I take a pause and I say, hey, I'm going to take the next year off and just see what comes. And what gets me out of bed in the morning is both that curiosity and the fact that my kids are at my bed pretty much around 6:30 saying, Daddy, get up.
I feel like we are in a sort of changing headwinds of culture, and when you and I were coming up as college students, early professionals, there was a huge premium put on hustle culture. We looked at the guys like Dame Dash. And like,
sleep when you're dead.
Exactly. And we now exist in a world where that is looked at as an anachronism. And
it's strange. Like, you'll watch a Powerade commercial, and it's like, pause. Take time for you. And I'm like, that is not how we grew up.
Yes. And so I'm curious, how have you adapted yourself to that? And also, you manage an office with hundreds of employees, many of whom are young millennials, Gen Z, who put their personal work-life balance at the top of their sort of priority list.
It's not even adjusting my game. I've changed. I wake up every morning and cold plunge and meditate. So I'm kind of evolving in that way, too. What I think it is having that balance of there also has to be action, not just a pause. And also, I don't hold on so tight anymore. It's the young people that are working here, they're going. I used to think it was my responsibility to make sure we're all successful. And now I realize, with the help of some of the young people who used to work for me, having really candid conversations with me about their own ambitions and not thinking it's my responsibility to get them there, I realize that we can provide a platform, but people are going to, or they're going to make their own journey. And that's not my responsibility. My responsibility is to show up with integrity and show up with drive and show up with honesty and do the best job I possibly can do and be the best team member I can be. But I don't have to carry that weight anymore.
Do you think you could have achieved what you've achieved if you had this sort of approach for work?
No. I think that I am in my journey where I'm supposed to be at this point. I have certain guys that, you know, men and women who are super successful, I've had conversations with who are older than me. And as I was coming up, they'd say, you got to be like this. They want you to learn all the lessons. And now I've come to realize that every single one of us have to learn the lessons on our own time. I had to be that way at 22. I had to be that way at 26. I had to be that way at 31. This is who I am at 41. And being those different versions of me gave me the perspective and the journey to get here. I don't think I would have gotten here without being exactly who I was at that place. But if I stay in that place, if I'm stagnant, if I just refuse to continue evolving, that's on me. And that's not okay with me. I hope to be better at 51 than I am at 41.
So when a 23-year-old comes up to you and is like, I want to be the next Scooter Braun, but I turn off my phone at 7 and I'm all about work-life balance, do you think that that person can achieve the type of success that you've achieved in this environment today?
It's funny. I feel, when you say it, I feel like this kind of thing inside of me that wants to scream, like, you don't have it. You know, because that's the way I was raised. But here's the honest answer. If they say to me the line you said, I want to be the next Scooter Braun, that's what's making me want to say that. Because they're not understanding what it took for me to get here in my journey. But no one should say that. There's only one me. This is how I'm going to know somebody's the next. If they say, hey, nice to meet you, my name is, and I'm going to be. I never wanted to be the next anything. I wanted to be me. And my journey was unique to me. If he says I go to bed at 7 and I have work-life balance, that might work for that person. And they're going to have a unique experience. And also, what is success? There's somebody right now that you and I have never heard of who's happy, who's content, who has joy in their life every single day, but they don't have the commercial success that we define as success. Everybody's on their own path. I have the privilege of not worrying about certain things these days because I've diversified, I've gone to a different place, I'm more mature. There's a lot of things that have changed. Anxiety still comes just in different ways. I think perspective, as a young person, you don't have the perspective of so many challenges in your life that you've had to overcome. I think facing adversity many times over allows you to be more calm in the storm. And I've had to face a lot of different adversities in different ways, whether it be with Ariana Manchester or helping the kids with March for Our Lives or things in my personal life or friends of mine going through something. Just you go through different adversity at different times. And I think just life, repeated opportunities to face adversity allow you to grow and understand and get through those waves faster and faster. So I don't think the anxiety goes away. I just think the challenges change, the learning changes, and you continue to grow and evolve. And I think if you and I do this 10 years from now, I'm going to talk about the adversity and the struggles and the growth that I've had in the last 10 years.
And hopefully we will do it again in 10 years. Life is long, and even when from the outside it looks like you've got the game on lock, it continues to toss you curveballs when you least expect it. And that's the thing about Scooter. He has manufactured successes for himself that exceed far beyond what any of us will ever experience in our lives. However, that doesn't make him any less human, or any less vulnerable to the challenges, be they internal or external, professional or personal, that he's faced. And that's why I find the value of his insights so universal in its application. There's a lot to learn about how he accomplished what he accomplished. It starts with ambition, his belief in self and his unflinching work ethic, and it extends into his ability to network authentically, providing untransactional value to those he encounters. And then, of course, there's his preternatural feel for the zeitgeist. He knows what people, broadly speaking, think and want. It's a superlative combination that he's unlocked, but it's also a blueprint that can be followed. However, all of that said, there's even more for us to learn from how he's dealt with hardships. Whether it's taking the high road and focusing on his own business when detractors with a larger platform throw shots, or when he's found it imperiled, addressing issues within his personal life with an even greater urgency than he's notoriously applied to his professional life, there's a lot for all of us to emulate. Scooter is a work in progress and an open book about his journey. As someone who aspires to get better with each passing day, I'm grateful for his candor. Knowledge and insight are meant to be shared, and if we can all strive to be as transparent about our wins and our losses as Scooter, then the entire creative community is stronger for it. For Idea Generation, I'm Noah Callahan Bever. Thanks for tuning in. If you've enjoyed this episode, please do us a favor and show your support and leave us a rating, or better yet, a review on your podcast platform of preference. It takes only a couple seconds out of your day, but it can make a world of difference in helping others discover this show. And of course, don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.